The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking level, adjusting camera, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
You know, I think my favorite line in that intro is, reboots computer, because, you know, the gremlins get me. Although, we're doing okay, knocking on wood laminate. It seems, and YouTube chat room, please correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that we have taken care of the warbly, underwater-sounding audio, right? I think we made it through this whole week and didn't have any of that. Now, there's sync issues, but we're working on it, you know, one thing at a time. Unfortunately, we can't follow that prescription in real life. You can't just say, wait a minute, too much shit is hitting the wall all at once. Let's just concentrate on one thing at a time. That would be too easy, wouldn't it? So instead, you know, we still got COVID. We've got Ukraine and Afghanistan, Ukraine and Russia. We've got, issues around the elections, and not because our election system is so broken and corrupt. Although we do have problems with some of the machines, and we'd be better off with hand counted paper ballots, but. It's, you know, we're being gaslit by the Republican Party on every front. I mean, it's one thing after another after another. And then this shooting just totally it makes you want to throw up your hands and say, I'm done. I give up. I don't know what to do anymore. So yesterday, I was understandably, I think, livid about the reports that had come out that telling us that the cops... that the first narrative we heard of the police response in Texas, in Uvalde, Texas, the first thing we heard was, well, they engaged the shooter right when he got out of the car. They shot at him, but he was wearing body armor, so the bullets didn't hurt him, and he went into the school and he started shooting. Well, now we find out that's not true at all. And in fact, they never engaged the shooter with guns before he went in. And it wasn't just a matter of seconds between the time when he crashed the truck in the ditch 100 yards, from the opening to the school. It wasn't just a matter of seconds or minutes. It was 12 minutes, and he was shooting the gun. There were something like 100 spent rounds found outside of the school. So this man, this thing, this creature, this monster was shooting, and there was police presence there. Why nobody took him out, I don't know. Now, yesterday, I was going off on the fact that we find out that parents are freaking out outside. They're hearing gunfire coming from inside the school, and the cops are all standing around with their hands up their asses, right? Seemingly doing nothing. And now we find out 19, funny number, isn't it? 19 police officers were in the halls of the school, but they didn't try to enter the classroom where the shooter was still murdering kids. And so yesterday the press conference they held in this town was infuriating because the guy who was answering the questions didn't answer any questions. So today they brought out the big guns. This guy, and I don't know his name, and frankly, I don't care what his name is. This guy is the director of the Texas Department of Public Services, DPS. I was thinking it was Department of Police Service. No, it's Public Services. So he's, I guess, in charge of law enforcement throughout the state. And they brought him in because, the media and the people were getting understandably more and more frustrated because they weren't answering the important questions. Today, we got some answers. And the answers were ugly. So let's start with this one. Okay, so this reporter is thanking him for, you know, doing his job, right? Okay, and he's asking about all the officers in the hallway outside of the classroom and why they didn't go in.
What efforts were the officers making to try and break through either that door or another door?
That door or another door? Okay, it's a long-winded question. Here we go.
The on-scene commander at the time?
The on-scene commander at the time.
Had transitioned from an active shooter to a barricaded subject.
The on-scene commander believed it had transitioned from an active shooter to a barricaded guy.
We're well aware of that.
Right. Yeah. Why was this decision made
not to go through the door? Is the question.
On-scene commander considered it a barricaded subject and that there was time and there were more children at risk. Obviously, based upon the information we have, there were children in that classroom that were at risk, and it was, in fact, still an active shooter situation and not a barricaded subject.
Hello? It was an active shooter and not a barricaded subject. Well, I could have told you that. All those parents could have told you that. In fact, when they tried to tell the multitude of law enforcement on the scene, they were handcuffed and tased and pepper sprayed. Parents who were worrying that their children were being gunned down inside, and some of them were right. And these cops are arresting the parents for impeding an investigation. Well, it seems to me that there was no investigation, that the commander on the scene... Let me tell you who the commander on the scene was. I don't have the names, but I did watch this press conference all the way through. The commander, the police chief, as they referred to him, it gets even more infuriating. The police chief is the chief of this school unit. You know how many people are under his command? Three. The school resource officers are under this police chief. This is his force. Because he's the commander of the school police force. He has three officers under him. He's a step up from the hall monitor. And they're letting this guy make the call? Now, I heard interviews with law enforcement and former law enforcement. And down to one, they all said, if you're in a situation like this, you're outside of the classroom where there's an active shooter. You know that kids are in there. They're calling 911. For an hour, the few kids who were still alive were calling 911 and saying, there are 8 or 9 of us alive. Where are the police coming? Over an hour! An hour! Sorry, I said I wasn't going to raise blood pressure today, but oh my God. And so... all right, Mr. Commander Man. So first of all, it's the officer's duty, if they know there's an active shooter in there and your commander is telling you stand down, to say, hell no, I'm going to go save those kids. Who's with me? We'll deal with the consequences later. Not one of them did that, even though they heard the screams. So here's another piece from that same press conference. And these are the words that I promise you, not one of those 19 sets of parents is taking any comfort from these words, from what the head of Texas law enforcement said.
The question simply is this. There was a 40-minute gap. And if the 911 operators were aware that, that children were alive in that classroom,
they were.
Why weren't officers notified of
good
that?
Good question.
If that's the case, why didn't they take action?
Good question.
That's the question.
Yes,
and
good question.
Again, I'll go back to the answer for right now, is that it was considered, okay, the decision was made on the scene. I wasn't there, but at the same point in time, you know, a decision was made that this was a barricaded subject situation. There was time.
There wasn't.
To retrieve the keys and wait for a tactical team with the equipment
to go
in and breach the door and take on the subject at that point. That was the decision. That was the thought process at that particular point in time.
And it was wrong.
What?
What about the parents? What do you tell the parents?
And there was 19, like I said, there were 19 officers in there.
In fact,
there was plenty of officers to do whatever needed to be done, with one exception, is that the incident commander inside believed they needed more equipment and more officers to do a tactical breach at that point. That's why BORTAC was requested on the scene. As soon as they were there, they executed a search, or at least a dynamic entry, and went in. And, of course, that was not till 12. That was not till 12:57.
Not till 12:57.
Hey, with the benefit of hindsight, stand by, right? I got it.
Guy?
Hey, for the benefit of hindsight, where I'm sitting now, then of course it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision, period. There's no excuse for that. But again, I wasn't there, but I'm just telling you, from what we know, we believe there should have been an entry at that as soon as you can. Hey, when there's an active shooter, the rules change. It's no longer, okay, it's no longer a barricaded subject. You don't have time. You don't worry about outer perimeters. And by the way, Texas embraces active shooter training.
Oh, fuck you. Texas embraces active shooter training? Well, obviously, they didn't learn very much. And you keep referring to the guy who supervises three whole school officers in Uvalde, Texas, as the police chief. Get over it. He's not a chief. He's an errand boy who made a bad call, and somebody should have stopped him. Because what we learned is that the shooter went into the classroom, immediately killed the first teacher, said good night, and then shot her dead. Then he opened fire, sprayed bullets around the room, and mowed down a bunch of kids. But there were still other kids alive, and they were calling 911. The New York Times has a little timeline here. 12:03 p.m. of student calls 911, whispers she's in the room. She's in room 112. That was at 12:03. At 12:10, she called back and said there are multiple people dead. 12:13, she called again. 12:16, she called again, and that's when she said there are 8 or 9 kids alive in here. Get somebody here. And having to play dead and be quiet so the shooter doesn't come and kill her. 12:19, a student calls from room 111. That's the room next door. 12:21, three shots are heard on the call. So you have the 911 operators who know that there are children alive in there. And yet they made a call. They decided that it was no longer an active shooter situation. It was a barricaded subject.
Bullshit.
That's fucking bullshit. 12:36, another call. 12:43, asks for police. 12:47, asks for police. She first called at 12:03. I'm going to play something for you. So John Berman, who does the CNN morning show along with Breonna Keeler, is there. And he had the story of this girl, the one who played dead. And this girl, first of all, is right now terrified to be around a man. So she would only speak with a woman. And the little girl and her mother spoke with John Berman's producer because she's a woman. This is how traumatized this child is. And that's only the beginning of it. I want to play for you And she didn't want to go on camera. She didn't want to be photographed. So the producer was telling John Berman about their conversation.
But Mia is so scared of men right now because of what happened that she only feels comfortable speaking with women.
Amazing.
She also did not want to go on camera. She did agree to speak with my partner, CNN producer Nora Noose. Nora, you were in with Mia and her mother. I want to make clear her mother was there the whole time. What did she tell you?
So 11-year-old Mia Cirio was in that fourth grade classroom that we've heard so much about with Miss Garcia and Miss Mireles. She said they were watching Lilo and Stitch because it was the end of the school year. They'd finished their lessons. And she said one of her teachers got an email that there was a shooter in the building and went to the door and he was right there. And they made eye contact.
The shooter made eye contact with the teacher.
With the teacher. And then he shot out the window in the door. And then Mia says it just happened all so fast. He backed the teacher into the classroom. And he made eye contact with the teacher again, looked her right in the eye, and said, good night, and then shot her and killed her.
Horrible.
He said good night before he shot her.
Good night. And then it happened pretty fast after that as well. He started open firing in the classroom. He hit the other teacher, a lot of Mia's friends. At that point, Mia was hit by fragments of the bullets. You could even see them yesterday, I mean, on her back, on her shoulders, the back of her head.
The shooter then, she says, went into the adjoining classroom.
Yeah, so he went through this door to the adjoining classroom, and at that point, Mia could hear screams. She heard a lot more gunfire. And then she said she heard music. She thinks it was the gunman that put it on.
He played music.
He started blasting sad music. And I asked her, like, what was that? Like, what kind of music? What do you mean by that? And she just said it sounded like I want people to die music.
Oh, lovely.
She said she heard music. She said it sounded like I want people to die music. Mm-hmm. What did Mia do then?
So she had a friend next to her that she was pretty sure was already dead and was laying on the ground bleeding out. And she put her hands in her friend's blood and then smeared it, she said, all over her body.
Oh, my God.
She wanted to look like she was dead.
Can you imagine the presence of mind of this little girl, 11 years old? She saw her teacher shot in the face, killed dead. She saw her friends around her dying. She had the presence of mind to put her hand in the blood of her friend who was lying, either dying or already dead, on the ground next to her, and smear the blood all over her so she would look like she was hit and dead as well. And she kept calling. She got a teacher's phone. I guess when the shooter went in the other room, she and a friend took the phone from the dead teacher and called 911. She's the one who was calling 911. But wait, there's more.
Dead. She was scared that the gunman was going to come back through that adjoining door back into the classroom. And she wanted to be able to play dead.
She also told you that she called 911.
Yeah, so after she smeared the blood all over her body, she and a friend went and were able to take the phone off of one of the teachers who had already been killed. And they called 911, and they were actually able to make contact with the dispatcher. And they talked to a dispatcher for a little while and told them what was going on inside. And Mia kept saying, telling me that she kept saying, we're in trouble, we're in trouble.
We're in
like,
trouble.
Please come, we're in trouble.
One of the interesting things you told me is that Mia said to you that she felt like it all lasted for 3 hours.
Yeah, she was like, oh, yeah, I was in there for 3 hours. And her mom said, well, sweetheart, I think it was closer to 1 hour, but I'm sure it felt that way.
And what did Mia think the police were doing during this time?
She said she thought the police just hadn't gotten there yet.
Oh,
that somehow
God.
They just weren't there yet. And she said, you know, she'd been pretty stoic up until this point in the interview. And this was actually when she started getting emotional and started crying. She said, I heard the grown-ups later say the police were outside and that they weren't coming in. And she got emotional talking to me about this and said,
you know, imagine?
Why didn't they come in? Why didn't they save us? Why the police were outside? Like, she just couldn't. It was clear in her 11-year-old brain.
I can't get it either.
Why they wouldn't come in and help and save her.
So, again, you spent some time with her and her mother. She's obviously just been through the worst thing, hopefully, that she'll ever go through in her entire life. You know, how did she seem to you? How did she look to you?
honestly not great.
What do you expect? So that's the gist of it. You know, she's injured where she was shot. You know, she had shrapnel hit her back. So there's, you know, spots all over her back and her arms and the back of her head. And she's losing her. Her hair is falling out where she got hit by shrapnel from these bullets. That's how much damage they do. But don't take my word for it. We're gonna segue here. Let me tell you what's going on. So tomorrow, Monday, is Memorial Day. And, you know, Memorial Day is a day to honor those Americans who have been killed in battle, ostensibly protecting their country. And yes, good reason to have a day honoring our war dead. But we need another Memorial Day to honor the victims of gun violence in this country. This is horrendous. There's no excuse for this. There's no reason for this country to be this way. And it is only this country. You heard by now Ted Cruz and how he couldn't handle a reporter from Sky News. You saw this, right? I'm going to play it for you because everyone needs to see what a piece of shit, chicken shit, Ted Cruz is. So Sky News is a British broadcaster, British news organization.
Who are never going to get to kiss their child goodnight again.
Is this the moment to reform gun laws?
You know, it's easy to go to politics.
Oh, fuck you. It's not
important.
Politics.
It's at the heart of the issue.
I get that that's where the media likes to go.
It's not.
It's where many of the people we've talked to here like to go.
The proposals from Democrats in the media, inevitably, when some violent psychopath murders people.
A violent psychopath who's able to get a weapon so easily. 18-year-old with two AR-15s.
If you want to stop violent crime.
Yeah.
The proposals the Democrats have, none of them would have stopped this.
But why does this only happen in your country? I really think that's what many people around the world
just cannot fathom.
Why only in America? Why is this American exceptionalism so awful?
You know, I'm sorry you think American exceptionalism is awful.
I think this aspect of it.
You got your political agenda.
No, it's honestly.
God love you.
Senator, it's not. I just want to understand why you do not think that guns are the problem.
Why is this just an American problem?
Well, it is just an American problem, sir.
Mr. Cruz, why is America the only country that faces this kind of mass shooting?
But you can't answer that. You can't answer that, can you, sir? You can't answer that. Why is this country?
Why is it that people come from all over the world to America? Because it's the freest, most prosperous, safest country on earth.
It's not the same thing.
Maybe the freest, maybe the most popular.
Why are our kids dying in school?
And Ted Cruz does what Ted Cruz does best. Run away! Run away! It's a Monty Python thing. Run away! He's really good at that. I'm surprised he hasn't gone to Cancun yet. So, I taped an interview earlier this week. Actually, I was going to play it on Monday, but I'm going to play it now because it's Memorial Day on Monday. And my guest is a man named Naveed Shah, and he's the political director for a progressive veterans group. No, I didn't realize there was a progressive veterans group. It's called it's called Common Defense. They're at commondefense.org, I believe. I believe it's .org. They're on Twitter at Common Defense. And we talk about everything. So I decided I'd play that today, and we do talk about everything. I think you'll enjoy the interview. I think it's fascinating, and it's good to know because our military, it seems to be so skewed rightward that there is this progressive group of veterans, so you'll learn about them. But I decided Monday, as I tend to do sometimes on holidays, I'm going to do a music show. So YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, Facebook viewers, there will not be any streaming video on Monday. It'll just be an audio show on Progressive Voices at progressivevoices.com, on my stream, both at NicoleSandler.com on the Listen Live page and on my I have a dedicated stream you can get to just by going to NicoleSandlerStream.com. And when I'm not on the air, it's usually the Progressive Voices channel playing. So you'll hear Brad Friedman at 8 o'clock at night. Mike Malloy following him. So if you want to hear those shows, an easy way to get to Progressive Voices if you don't have the app is go to NicoleSandlerStream.com. So anyway, that's what's going to be on Monday. I'll be here. But I can't stream it onto YouTube because we'll be playing music and they will copyright violate me. So I'm not going to take that chance. But there is a chat room at NicoleSandler.com/listen-live. I don't know that it's letting anyone sign on, but you can try. Anyway, we'll try. So that's what's going to happen Monday. Now I'm going to share with you this interview because, well, you know, because we can, and because, it's Memorial Day on Monday. So take it away, Nicole.
All right. Joining us on the line now is the political director for an organization called Common Defense. They're at commondefense.us. Naveed Shah, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. And we're here today because it's Memorial Day, and you are the political director of a group of progressive veterans, right? Tell us about Common Defense.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Nicole. Common Defense was really a movement that started in 2015, and our founders met at a protest outside of Trump Tower, and they, you know, realized back then that when the 2016 election happened, that this couldn't just be a flash in the pan. This needed to become a sustained movement and a sustained organization. So they created Common Defense. And we spent much of the past 4 years fighting against Trump and all of the hate and vitriol that he stood for. And now we are continuing to do so in advocating for issues that our constituency of progressive veterans care about. And one of the biggest things to talk about first, just off the bat, is that progressive veterans are a constituency. Everyone thinks that there are conservative veterans and that's it. But the fact of the matter is that veterans span the breadth of America, just like everyone else does. And there are a lot more of us out there than people realize.
And that's the thing that we don't realize, because we do hear the horror stories first from all fronts, where it seems like the military is populated with an overabundance of right wingers. You look at, you know, the military, religious, now I'm drawing a blank on their name, Military Religious Freedom Foundation, that fights back against religious extremism in the military to the point where there's Bible verses engraved on weapon sites and things like that, things that we don't know about. But I guess a religious zealotry has infiltrated the military, so you guys have to contend with that. To a lot of right wing, we know that there was a pretty strong military and police presence on January 6th. So we need to hear that there are progressives in the military, because frankly, it doesn't seem like there are.
Yeah. And the fact of the matter is that the demographics are changing. You know, who we thought veterans were, or even when you think about a veteran, you're often thinking of a certain type of person. But in an all volunteer force that largely recruits from the poorest sections of America, women and minorities are actually the fastest growing segment of veterans. And so as those demographics are changing, we see that the ideals and the values that we hold as a country are being much more reflected in our force and in our veteran population.
Well, that's great. And I'm glad that Common Defense exists so we can hear about the progressive veterans. In fact, I know one, I don't know if he's a member of yours, and I'm frankly surprised he's not on your endorsement page at commondefense.us, but Lucas Kuntz, who's running for the U.S. Senate from Missouri, is certainly a progressive and definitely a veteran.
And you know what? It's really funny you say that. I was talking to Lucas Kuntz's campaign manager earlier this week. Stay tuned for more good news.
Good, because he deserves to be among the candidates you've endorsed. And I'm looking at the page. It's John Fetterman and Stacey Abrams, Greg Kassar, Jessica Cisneros, Marcus Flowers. So you're right in line with my listeners and where I am. And so it's great to meet you. I mean, there are other veterans groups that are somewhat progressive, but the fact that that's your main thrust, I love it. And I'm glad to introduce you to the listeners who don't know about commondefense.us. So one of the issues that you are rightfully concerned about and want to raise some awareness of in this this Memorial Day is the vets who are suffering as a result of what you call toxic materials exposure. Those are the burns, right, that take place on the bases around the world. Yes, and what happens there?
Yeah, so I was deployed to Iraq in 2009, and actually from between 2009 and 2010, the Department of Defense issued a new rule that they were supposed to stop using these burn pits, but they didn't in many places. They just didn't have any other choice. And those burn pits is how we got rid of waste, you know, whether it was garbage or medical waste or munitions or any all types of things. We're just thrown into these giant pits and then set on fire with jet fuel or diesel or other things like that. And a lot of times it was up to the youngest soldiers to stand there with a stick and stir that mess to make sure it all got burned away. And, you know, we suffered from that now. Like years and years later, veterans are suffering from all types of diseases that many of us have never even heard of, carcinomas and adrenocarcinomas. I can't even pronounce all of them, but there's a list. And what this bill, this legislation does, the Honoring Our Pact Act that was passed by the House in March and is currently up for debate in the Senate, it makes it so that the Veterans Affairs Health Administration will presumptively assume that veterans who serve in these areas near these burn pits have disabilities related to it and are able to get the health care that they need. Right now, veterans have to jump through so many hoops. And, you know, that's really par for the course for America, where we write a giant check to send folks overseas. But when they come home and they need care, now all of a sudden money is an issue. And so what this bill does is makes it so that veterans can get the care that they need. This is our generation's Agent Orange.
Yeah, it is. And, I guess we should thank John Stewart for calling attention to this, because this is now after the 9/11 fund, getting that going. And I don't know where that stands right now. This is where he's putting his energies. And I guess it takes a big name celebrity to get out there and talk about what's going on, because it's hard to cut through all the noise. So that is a big issue. Let me ask you about the VA today, because I understand that veterans do get great medical care if you can work your way through the system. The core of the VA medical is terrific, but there are, I guess, bureaucratic issues. Is it getting any better? What's the status of the VA now?
You know, years and years ago, I started out in this work working specifically on veterans issues because of how much trouble the VA was in. There was a huge scandal at the Phoenix, Arizona VA, and that was just one example of all the different scandals that the VA has faced. And luckily, over the years, things have gotten better. The VA is doing a lot better job of caring for our community. Part of what this legislation does is expand access to care. And that's one huge aspect of this, is that a lot of people think that, oh, you serve in the military, you get free health care for life. That's not the case. Actually, the vast majority of veterans don't, really? Aren't eligible for VA health care. Yeah. You have to either be injured or retired or go through another process in order to be qualified to use the VA. And so while the majority of veterans aren't on VA care, they have to rely on the civilian system anyway. So part of what this bill does is opens it up so that almost 3.5 million veterans will now become eligible for VA care. So with that, we also need to make sure that the VA expands its capacity to provide this care that we're going to need. And they need to be able to hire doctors. Currently, the VA has a shortfall of almost 50,000 employees, and the majority of those are nurses and doctors and other medical professionals. We need to make sure that the VA is able to provide the care that they're promising.
You know, something that I've often wondered about is if we had Medicare for all, this would be a moot point, right? Because veterans could also get medical care under that, and the VA could deal with veterans' issues without having to deal with medical care. And then all of our citizens could have good medical care, which, you know, is should be the goal, right?
Yeah, that's a huge thing that our constituency of progressive veterans care about a lot, because we realize that even in places where you have a veteran in the household who is on the VA healthcare system, their family's not.
Right.
Right. Their family's not able to get that care. And so Medicare for All would uplift everybody, because it would provide for their families. It would really help us save the VA from this privatization screw that's been going on. A lot of people think the solution to fixing the VA is to push veterans out of the VA system and go to get care in the private community.
Oh, God, no.
But VA healthcare specialists, they specialize in caring for ailments that come from military service. And like you said earlier, veterans, by and large, who've received care at the VA, love their doctors, love their clinics, and want to continue using them. All Medicare for All would do is make it so that everybody has a similar level of access, because with private insurance, you might have some choice. That's really isn't really a choice. If your insurance company says that doctor is not part of our network, or this doctor is not part of our network. With Medicare for All, veterans will be able to use the VA where appropriate. And if veterans in rural communities or those who just choose not to go to the VA will be able to go to a private doctor of their choice and be able to get the care that they want.
Right. It just makes sense, doesn't it?
It really does.
You know, Naveed Shah is with us, political director of the Organization for Progressive Veterans. It's called Common Defense. They're online at commondefense.us. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about our gun problem here in the U.S. Just within 2 weeks, two mass shootings. The one in Buffalo killed 10 people. And then this Texas elementary school, I'm just reeling from it still. Thinking that 10 years ago, we should have stopped this after Sandy Hook. Well, Sandy Hook never should have happened. But here we are 10 years later, 19 dead children, babies, second to fourth grade. There's no excuse for this. And again, the shooter on his 18th birthday purchased two assault weapons. These are weapons of war. Is there any reason a civilian who goes hunting should ever have an AR-15?
You know, if you're going hunting with AR-15s, then you're not really bringing much back, because it's going to leave a pretty big hole in that deer. And so that argument really never made sense to me. And honestly, this morning, I have three kids, and, you know, my daughters were helping me make my coffee this morning. And I just stood there watching them. And I was like, wow, like there are, you know, 20 families at home without their kids today. And it's horrific, you know, when we think about this. Common sense gun laws are really a continuation of what we did in the military. In the military, if we weren't at war, we didn't carry our weapons everywhere. Uh-huh. We had an armory to safely store our weapons, right? We checked them in and out. We accounted for every round of ammunition. We had the military's mental health care system is not the best in the world, but we had a team around us so that if you were downrange and you have a soldier who you think it might be a danger to themselves or others, you are able to take their weapon, provide them with the care and treatment that they need. And then when they're ready to come back on the line, then we can have that discussion. But to just have a free-for-all the way we do is, you know, absolutely terrifying. And the other aspect of this that, you know, the gun control is definitely one big piece. But the other thing that happened in Buffalo was the radicalization of that young man. You know, he went online and read terrible things and took them to heart. And we really have to address that Scrooge of white supremacy. That's you know, really haunting our country at the moment. Millions of young people who are very easily influenced, and we have to address the core of that issue, that they're not being radicalized. It seems like the dark corners of the web are always come up, but it's happening live on mainstream TV every night in prime time as well. So we really need to figure out who's responsible for this and hold them responsible for it.
You know, Naveed, I want to hone in on one point that you made there, because I don't think enough people realize this. The other night, as they were trying to identify the remains of these children, I heard that they had some of the parents who were waiting gave DNA samples now to identify the kids. And that's because of the carnage, because of the scene that was left there. An AR-15 You say it's not good for hunting because these weapons are designed to do maximum damage. So the bullet hits and then it shatters, right? So what was left there were probably, you know, the Republicans like to talk about body parts of aborted children. Well, children aren't aborted. Zygotes, maybe, but not children. In this case, children were killed, were murdered, were probably dismembered and in pieces because of the weapon used to murder them, right?
Yeah, it was. It's absolutely really horrific to think about. And you know, allowing these weapons just to just proliferate without any sort of regulation at all. I mean, that's not even in the broadest reading of the Second Amendment. That's not even in that reading. Regulation is the key. Just like
well-regulated militia. To me, that sounds like the National Guard.
Yeah, it really should be. And if someone really needs that that type of weaponry, they should probably ask themselves, what do I need this for? And am I going to be a responsible gun owner? Can I keep my weapon locked up safely? Can I keep my ammunition locked up safely? And if you're, you know, in the case of this, the young man in Texas, if you see someone like that purchasing those weapons, your first response as a family member should be, what's happening here? Why are you doing this? Why do you think this is necessary? And many states have enacted something called red flag laws, which allow family members and others who are concerned about, you know, somebody to go to court and say, I think this person is a danger to themselves or others, and we need to remove the weapons from their household until they get some treatment and are safe again. And I think that allows for due process, that allows for, you know, it's not just somebody coming to your home and taking your gun. A judge at least has to review it. And I think those kind of laws, at the very minimum, states could start enacting those immediately.
Absolutely. You know, there was some talk after Newtown that maybe they should have released crime scene photos so people could be shocked at what they see. Maybe if people understand the damage done by these weapons of war, maybe that would shock this nation into doing something. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's scary to think about and even to imagine what that would look like. And having been to Iraq and Afghanistan, like many of our veterans have, you know, I don't think we want to see that. And I hope that our senators and our members of Congress are listening, that, you know, we don't want this to get any more extreme than it already has. Like, what more do you need to see to take action?
Right. How do they not know it at all? Or how do they not come to terms with what's going on? We have a, you know, we're coming through the COVID pandemic. Our gun violence pandemic is a hell of a lot worse because you don't know when it's coming. You can't really prepare against it. You send your kid off to school in the morning thinking that they're safe, and now nothing is safe. One last topic for you, because we're out of Afghanistan, thank God. Well, now we have Putin waging war on Ukraine, and we're seeing these Russian troops not only destroying this magnificent country and its thousands of years of history, but terrorizing and brutalizing and torturing innocent Russians, from the elderly to babies. The stories we're hearing are just sickening. Are we doing the right thing in Ukraine? What should we be doing now?
You know, it's a really difficult balancing act when it comes to the foreign policy, especially in a situation like Ukraine, because we saw what happened in Iraq and we saw what happened in Afghanistan and many other countries around the world where the U.S. has been involved and our troops have been deployed over the past 20 years in this global war on terror, as we've called it. Getting us entrenched into another conflict is not the way we should go. We should try our best to avoid sending U.S. troops in, because honestly, I don't think it's going to make the situation better. I think it will be escalatory. And when you have somebody like Vladimir Putin at the helm, you don't know what his reaction might be. And if he decides to react in the worst possible way, well, that, you know, could be a pretty big blast.
But right? he could also choose to react in the worst possible way, because he's getting his ass handed to him in Ukraine when he thought it was going to take 48 hours and the country would fall. So it's not necessarily dependent on what we do, and we're seeing these innocent people getting slaughtered.
Yeah, no, and we're doing our best to provide as much support to them as we can. You know, and it is hard to see those images for sure. And I know from our own point of view that there are a lot of veterans who are members who have decided to go and fight in Ukraine themselves, because for them, after serving in Afghanistan or in Iraq, which the justification for those was tenuous at best, and I think we even heard President Bush say something recently about Iraq that was a little too on the nose. But for them now, seeing this situation in Ukraine, is for many of them, it's like there's a clear good and bad here. There's a clear right and wrong, and it's easy for me to justify why I want to go fight. And so it's a really difficult challenge for us, because I don't want to see another generation of young Americans get dragged into this. But at the same time, it is hard to see what's happening in Ukraine to the innocent civilians and not think, what more can we do?
Exactly. It's a tough balancing act. I would think that the world has a way to stop a madman from slaughtering innocent people and destroying a country. And yet it seems like the world is afraid to take him on because he might use his nukes. Well, you know what? He might use them anyway. I'm not a warmonger. It kills me to even be thinking this way. But yet when we hear the stories of they found 1,500 bodies in Kyiv, just outside of Kyiv, you realize what's going on over there. And how can this man be allowed to continue doing this? It's a rhetorical.
We really need our European allies to step up and do more on their end as well, because it's not just on America. It's on everybody to help out.
That's true. Yeah. And finally, you did mention George W. Bush, who in a moment of, some say it's a Freudian slip, but, what I say is maybe he's coming to the realization or admitting finally that he knows what he did was evil and wrong. For those who don't recall, hold on, let me get the clip out. I know we've all heard it, but it bears listening to again because it's so incredible.
In contrast, Russian elections are rigged. Political opponents are imprisoned or otherwise eliminated from participating in the electoral process. The result is an absence of checks and balances in Russia.
That is why I must discuss
the decision of one man to launch a wholly unjustified and brutal invasion of Iraq. I mean, of Ukraine.
Iraq to anyone.
Hold on, sorry, something's playing that's not supposed to be.
That's the telling point to me. And the laugh is a nervous laugh, and he always did that. The audience laughter was disconcerting. But the thing that stuck out to me is him saying Iraq too, but... What? Oh
yeah,
my God.
We started that war in 2003. I joined the army in 2006, and I was worried back then that the war would be over by the time I finished my training. I ended up serving there in 2009, came home in 2010, and here we are in 2022, and we still actually have troops stationed in Iraq.
Of course.
That war hasn't really ended for us. And so, on the 19th anniversary now of that, I think it was earlier this month, the 19th anniversary of when President Bush stood on the, I think it was the USS Abraham Lincoln with the banner, mission accomplished behind him.
Right. The codpiece and the banner, of course.
Yeah. We're still there. And I think that also goes back to Congress. We need to... pass legislation that makes it so that Congress does its job under the Constitution, which is its war powers authority. Abdicating that to the executive too much is what has allowed wars like Iraq and Afghanistan and the 38 under other countries we've been deployed to around the world for the past 20 years to fester.
Yeah, no kidding. Ugh, we could keep going because there are so many issues here. But Navid Shah, it's great to meet you. And it's wonderful to find out that there is an organization for progressive veterans. It's Common Defense. They're online at commondefense.us. You can find them on Twitter at Common Defense. And also follow you as well at Army of Navid, N-A-V-E-E-D. Navid Shah, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it, and hope we can keep the lines of communication open because... progressives should not just cede the military to the right wingers. And it's good to know that there are progressives within the military. a military, as much as I hate it, is necessary. So it's good to know that it's not all in the hands of, you know, the crazies. I guess.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Nicole, and I really appreciate you and your listeners for your support.
You got it. What do you say? You don't say happy Memorial Day. That's something Ted Cruz would say. We're thinking of you on Memorial. What's the proper way to acknowledge Memorial Day?
You know, I think it's okay to say have a happy Memorial Day, have a nice Memorial Day weekend. We want to honor our troops. And one of the ways to do that is to be with friends and family, especially after the tragedies that our country has faced. You know, hold your people close.
So go enjoy your barbecue, enjoy your company, and be grateful for the freedoms we enjoy, and with a mind towards never letting it happen again.
Absolutely.
All right. Naveed Shah, thank you again. It was great to meet you.
Thanks, Nicole.
There you go. Naveed Shah, again, it is, what did I just say? The name of the organization, Common Defense. And they're at commondefense.us. So I was wrong. It's not .org. Commondefense.us. They're on Twitter at Common Defense. And and Naveed is at Army of Naveed, N-A-V-E-E-D. I don't know about you, but I was thrilled to learn that there is this progressive group for veterans. And as someone in the chat room pointed out, there are LGBTQ veterans groups as well. Well, good. See, these people, these groups need to be given a bigger spotlight, because frankly, all we do hear about are the right wing crazies, right? The people that the Military Religious Freedom Foundation tries to stop from their religious zealotry in the military. And of course, as I said, we saw all of those military people on January 6th, along with the insurrectionists. And that's really frightening, like really frightening. So, there we are. All right. We've only got a few minutes left. Again, a reminder that Monday there will be no video, but I will be streaming a show. It's Memorial Day, so, you know, as we said, enjoy the barbecues and the get-togethers and the day at the beach. I will provide the soundtrack for your barbecue. So from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern, 2 to 3 Pacific, it'll be a Memorial Day musical program. And yes, I'm going to try to mostly keep the songs to be about songs that are about the people who were killed in war, as evil as that is. So if you have any suggestions, feel free to send them in. David, do you want to say something?
We can't talk about LGBTQ veterans.
Oh, no, you can't say gay.
Not here.
No.
Not in Florida.
Well, I played for you the Ron DeSantis thing yesterday. Let me play for you something else that actually fired by mistake during that last interview. Sorry about that. Sometimes I hit the wrong button. But this is just brilliant. This is a kid, and I don't have his name, and I don't even know what high school he was from, but he was his student class president, the senior class president of his high school. And he's giving a speech at their graduation, but he's in Florida, and he can't say gay because, well, we have an idiot of a governor who passed this legislation. You can't say gay. So he got creative. Now, the audio is not the best, so listen carefully. The premise is he can't say he's gay, but he can say he has curly hair. Check this out.
That is why I must discuss a very public part of my identity. This characteristic has probably become the first thing you think of when you think of me as a human being. As you know, I have curly hair.
He has curly hair.
I used to hate my curls. I spent mornings and nights embarrassed at them, trying desperately to straighten this part of who I am. But the daily damage of trying to fix myself became too much to endure. So, while having curly hair in Florida is difficult, due to the humidity. I decided to be proud of who I was and started coming to school as my authentic self.
Yeah.
Here, it was Miss Ballard who answered my questions because I didn't have other curly-haired people to talk to. It was Mr. Pauling who read essays about girls costing me an opportunity that I really wanted. It was my friends that told me that girls look good on me and that I should stop fighting. It was a messy and twisted growth process, but eventually I did. It's because of the love I've drawn from this community that I came out to my family.
Huh. He came out to his family, right? As curly haired.
Now I'm happy.
Now I'm happy.
And that is what is at stake. There are going to be so many kids with curly hair who need a community like Pineview, and they will not have one. Instead, they'll try to fix themselves so that they can exist in Florida's humid climate. I've been preparing for this speech since I was elected my freshman year. Do you think that I wanted it to be about this? It needs to be about this for the thousands of curly-haired kids who are going to be forced to speak like this for their entire lives as students.
It's just amazing. I would love to hear the whole thing. Somebody in the chat room said that's up in like the Tampa Bay area, Sarasota area. But how brilliant is that? Because it's difficult here in Florida, especially because of the humid climate. Yeah, we know what he meant by humidity. All right, I'll leave you with one last thing. And this is a new discovery of mine, but I guess a lot of you knew of her already. She is the politics girl, and boy, does she know how to rant. Take it away, politics girl.
How much longer are we going to do this? Enough has been enough for decades. And yet the minority of the country in a bankrupted, Russian-funded lobby group run by sociopaths still allows us to live in a country where we can be gunned down by weapons of war just going about our daily lives, and we call that freedom. We had to have a lockdown quarantine to stop our citizens from being murdered. But now that we're getting back to normal, that means a return to daily mass shootings? Fuck you. No way. America, the country where owning an arsenal of weapons is as easy as buying a stick of gum. But voting is now going to require 15 hoops and the right color of skin. Fuck you. No way. Land of the free? Hardly. How free are we if we can't go to work, to school, to the grocery store, drive in our cars, go to a concert, a nightclub, or even be in our own home without worrying we might get shot to death by our domestic partner or some guy who can't get laid or a disgruntled worker or an alienated teenager or some fucking guy who thinks the world owes him? Why are our lives so much less important than your weapons? This country has a lot of problems, but I would argue none as big as patriarchal white supremacy coupled with easy access to firearms. Fuck you. We're done.
Fuck you. We're done. She talks my language, right? Yeah. You know, this has been just a really messed up week, like really incredibly horrible. And I'm looking to see if there's anything that I pulled for you that I haven't played yet. And I don't think so. You know what? I don't have the answers. But between all of us, we better come up with some answers pretty damn soon, because I'm afraid we're running out of time. I hope that all of this stuff, that the American people, especially those people who call themselves independents, those people who are swing voters, are really paying attention and looking at what the other party is offering them. Because if the Republicans win this next election, the overturning of Roe v. Wade is just the start of how horribly bad things are going to get around here. And bad doesn't even begin to say what's coming. Oh, I know what I wanted to read for you. So somebody posted this, and it goes back to, it's the date is May 3rd, 1994. And it's a letter signed by Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, and Gerald R. Ford. So three presidents. Dateline, dated May 3rd, 1994, to members of the U.S. House of Representatives. We are writing to urge your support for a ban on the domestic manufacture of military-style assault weapons. Again, Ronald Reagan signed this. This is a matter of vital importance to the public safety. Although assault weapons account for less than 1% of the crimes and the guns in circulation, they account for nearly 10% of the guns traced to crime. Every major law enforcement organization in America and dozens of leading labor, medical, religious, civil rights, and civic groups support such a ban. Most importantly, poll after poll shows that the American public overwhelmingly support a ban on assault weapons. A 1993 CNN USA Today Gallup poll found that 77% of Americans support a ban on the manufacture, sale, and possession of semi-automatic assault guns, such as the AK-47. The 1989 import ban resulted in an impressive 40% drop in imported assault weapons, traced to crime between 1989 and 1991, but the killing continues. Last year, a killer armed with two TEC-9s killed 8 people at a San Francisco law firm and wounded several others. During the past 5 years, more than 40 law enforcement officers have been killed or wounded in the line of duty by an assault weapon. And they finish up, they conclude by saying, while we recognize that assault weapon legislation will not stop all assault weapon crime, statistics prove that we can dry up the supply of these guns, making them less accessible to criminals. We urge you to listen to the American public and to the law enforcement community and support a ban on the further manufacture of these weapons. Again, this is a letter written to members of the U.S. House of Representatives, dated May 3rd, 1994, and signed by Gerald R. Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan. What more do you need? Stop the madness. Get rid of these weapons of war from our streets. With that, have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. I'll talk to you on the audio streams Monday, and I'll be back with video on Tuesday. Thanks for listening, everyone. Be safe this weekend, all right? I'll leave you with the news.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
We begin today with a split screen in Texas. On one side, the families of 21 people, 19 of them children, working through their grief and planning funerals. While on the other side, gun owners, dealers, and manufacturers begin their three-day gathering at the NRA's annual conference just miles down the road in Houston. But Ted Cruz and, well, the former guy, both confirmed that they will still attend. Texas Governor Greg Abbott did pull out of appearing live, announcing Thursday night that he'll address the conference using a pre-recorded statement. Okay. Meanwhile, parents in Uvalde, Texas, expressed anger Thursday as police revised the timeline of their response to the shooting. Immediately after the attack, Governor Abbott said a quick response saved lives. Well, police now say that the 18-year-old gunman lingered for 12 minutes outside the school after crashing his truck some 100 yards away from the entrance before entering. And contrary to initial reports, no police confronted the shooter before he went inside. He walked right in and began firing shots, which continued for about an hour until Border Patrol agents finally came in and killed him. Cell phone video showing parents pleading with the heavily armed police presence to go inside the school to do something to stop the shooter while he was still shooting up the place went viral. And on Thursday, we finally heard that parents were handcuffed, tased, and pepper sprayed by these police to keep them from running inside to find their children. And during a particularly weird and sketchy press conference that frankly raised more questions than it answered, Victor Escalon, a regional director for the Texas Department of Public Safety, admitted that some officers went inside to get their kids out during the standoff.
We've heard that some law enforcement officers actually went into school to get their kids out.
Right. So what we do know, Vanessa, right now, that there was some police officers, families trying to get their children out of the school because it was an active shooter situation right now. It's a terrible situation right now. And of course, just as we mentioned, the loss of life, it's just terrible. It's a terrible tragedy when it took place. But again, we got to keep acknowledging those brave men and women that actually were there on scene that met this suspect. And of course, we know that they were met with gunfire. Some of them were shot. But at the end of this, the suspect was shot and is now deceased. The threat is now neutralized.
Wow. And across the nation on Thursday, students at schools everywhere staged walkouts to protest gun violence and to say enough is enough. The president and first lady traveling to Uvalde, Texas on Sunday to grieve with the community that lost 21 lives. Since the shooting, President Biden has repeatedly called for new gun laws to prevent people like this 18-year-old shooter from legally buying weapons, like the AR-15 semi-automatic rifle he used in the attack. Biden saying, quote, "The Second Amendment is not absolute. When it was passed, you couldn't own a cannon. There's always been limitations." The surprising part is that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said that Republicans would work with Democrats to find a bipartisan solution that he says is directly related to the facts of this awful massacre. Good. So what does Congress do in the wake of yet another massacre in an elementary school claiming the lives of 19 children and two adults? Wrong. Well, if you're in the Senate, you leave for a two-week recess. But first, if you're a Republican, you vote to kill the Preventing Domestic Terrorism Bill, which had gained momentum after last week's shooting at a grocery store in Buffalo. But maybe this time something's different. A bipartisan group of senators is working on it, spearheaded by Chris Murphy of Connecticut, who became one of our biggest gun safety advocates after the Newtown shootings in his state claimed the lives of 20 first grade babies. We're coming up on the 10th anniversary of that horrible day in December. So the group of senators who met on Thursday included Democrats, well, Chris Murphy, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, Martin Heinrich of New Mexico, Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, and Republicans, Susan Collins, Pat Toomey, Lindsey Graham, and John Cassidy. And now we wait and see what they come up with. The Washington Post had a big scoop on Friday morning. We learned that White House officials are currently planning to cancel $10,000 in student debt per borrower. This after months of deliberation over how to structure loan forgiveness for tens of millions of Americans. The Post reporting that President Biden had hoped to make the announcement as soon as this weekend at the commencement address he's delivering at the University of Delaware. But that timing has changed after the massacre in Texas this week. The plan allegedly calls for limiting debt forgiveness to Americans who earned less than $150,000 in the previous year or less than $300,000 for married couples filing jointly. So we know that's coming. And a ruling, a New York State appeals court ruled Thursday that the former guy and two of his adult children, Donald Jr. and Ivanka, must submit to questioning under oath as part of a civil investigation into their business practices. Trump's lawyers had sought to block the testimony, arguing that the investigation being conducted was politically motivated. The legal team also said Trump and his children shouldn't have to talk to Letitia James investigators because the operations of the family property business, the Trump Organization, are the subject of a criminal investigation as well. The court found that the Trumps were not being unfairly singled out. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.